KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, Noah Baumbach, is a writer, director, who's made movies. I think of all as being kind of Bill Dunkelman. They're all coming-of-age stories in a way. Would you agree with that, Noah?
Yeah, as you say it, yes.
Had you not thought about it in that way before? Because they are, at some point, either an adult or a child really has to mature.
Yeah, I suppose it is about how we, looking at them as a whole, it is sort of how we continue to have to come of age.
Yeah, I thought about that too, because we were just talking before we got going, by the way, we're here to talk about Noah's new movie, Marriage Story. They're all about a body blow, kind of a trauma that a child has to deal with and really has to reorient himself after this thing happens.
Yeah, and I mean in Marriage Story as well, there is something infantilizing about the divorce process too. It's like, I mean, the way the legal system kind of takes over your life, the way lawyers kind of start speaking for you, almost like, you know, we see in the movie, Nicole and Charlie kind of almost are sort of stripped of their voices.
Their authority.
Their authority, their selfhood. There is something infantilizing about that. And, you know, on one level, you have two people who are parents who are trying to be the best parents to their kid and be parents during an incredibly emotional, disruptive process, and then at the same time are kind of being turned into children, you know, in a sense turned into children themselves.
And that happens in this movie when they meet with lawyers for the first time, and the lawyer that Nicole meets with couldn't be more maternal, offering her tea, I'll get you some of these cookies to take home with you, letting her talk, and Nicole has a breakdown, and when Charlie goes to see a lawyer, it's almost like he's dealing with a divorced dad. What's going on here? It's very different, but they're both these parental figures.
Right. Well, and you could say with Charlie's situation, with both Ray's character, Ray Liotta's character, Jay, is sort of maybe a more like authoritarian father. And then you have Alan Alda's character, Bert, who's kind of like the gentle father. But you're right that they both kind of take on maternal and paternal roles, at least initially, for these characters.
I was wondering how conscious that was, because right down to the way these offices are lighted in all three of these cases, there's nothing but windows and this oppressive, like, fluorescent light when Charlie goes in to see the lawyer he first talks to, Ray Liotta. Then when he goes to see Alan Alda, it's a much more inviting, it's almost like a therapist's office when he goes in.
Yeah, well, I thought, you know, there is also this sort of notion of home throughout the movie. I mean, we literally start in their home. You know, the opening montage is kind of daily life in and out of the home.
And also in their home, which is the theater.
Exactly. And then their work home and this sort of, and family, notions of family, the surrogate family of the theater. And then we have Nicole's childhood home, which, you know, it was home to her as a child. And here now she's an adult, sort of back with her own child in the bed that she grew up with, being woken up by her mother. That's kind of a home. That home is now no longer the home that it was. It sort of takes on a different meaning and role. And then, as you say, we kind of go into this with all these, once the sort of legal process begins, we go into all these offices, and we're dealing with sort of transitional spaces that are often created to kind of look like they have personality, but really have none. You know, it's like this sort of inoffensive way of presenting the world. And I did feel there was a kind of menace in some of that. Something Robbie Ryan shot the movie with me and I talked about, in the way we would frame things, and we would always make sure to get a kind of low angle wide of every one of these rooms, because there was something kind of, I felt sort of, in its lack of personality, there was kind of a sense of menace, you know. And But as you point out, Nora Fanshawe's office, played by Laura Dern, is presented as a kind of homey version of one of these places. And Bert Spitz's is a kind of, you know, maybe charming in its sort of ad hoc, you know, we see him fixing his lunch, you know, while he's, it's that there is this sort of, again, yeah, like, you know, home, fake home. Then later, of course, Charlie is trying to create a home in a transitional home and by buying plants, and he's like decorating it with, you know, his designer and, you know, rugs. And, you know, so that all of those sort of themes were kind of baked into the story.
But it's interesting to talk about this, just because home and what home means to the characters is really the bedrock of every movie you've made.
Mm-hmm. I think that's probably true. This notion of what we kind of hold on to, you know, what like you say, the body blows or what the world offers us, what we take with us, what we leave behind, those struggles, you know, who you know, how do we, you know, negotiate this life with, you know, family, both, you know, both the family we're born into and then family we acquire, friends, you know, how do these relationships, as we change and or don't change, you know, in the case of some of my characters, or refuse to change in the case of, you know, Greenberg or, you know, how do we negotiate the sort of changing world around us? And you're right, it does bring up this notion of home and in Marriage Story that is constantly changing and shifting, like where home is. Is it New York, LA? Is it the theater? Is it the TV station? Is it the rental in Los Angeles? Is it her mom's house? You know, I mean, all these sort of different places kind of present themselves.
I guess I was thinking too, because there's an opening where both Nicole and Charlie are offering up their positive takes on their partners, and she talks about how Charlie really built a home for himself. He's more of a New Yorker, though. He came from Indiana, mm-hmm. and left behind clearly a lot of family wreckage. He's turned New York by sheer force of will into a home.
Right, right. Well, I was interested in him and by people I know and characters I've studied, even artists who've come to New York, how they, in some ways, it's like make or break for them. They have to, you know, it's like if they didn't succeed, they would be eaten up by the city or they would just go back home or something. And, you know, and the ones who do make it somehow really do, they feel like they've always been there in a way. They've like made the city more their city than, you know, I came from Brooklyn. I sort of had the thing of feeling like an insider and an outsider because I both grew up in New York in a sense, but Brooklyn at that time felt like
it's a very different place.
Different place.
The equivalent of San Francisco, in fact.
Absolutely. I felt, and I really relate to friends of mine who grew up in different cities. You know, Greta grew up in Sacramento and saw New York as this sort of beacon of like culture and life and, you know, place she would hope to go to. Wes Anderson grew up in Houston, saw New York that way. They experienced New York through movies, through The New Yorker. I kind of had something similar, even though I could go into Manhattan. I still felt very far away from it in Brooklyn. It you know, in some ways, the fact that you could see it, Manhattan, and I guess when I say New York, I'm really talking about Manhattan, you know, it was like Saturday Night Fever. Like, I felt like I hope someday to make the trip across the bridge.
I guess I was thinking, too, because for somebody like Charlie, not somebody like Charlie, for Charlie, who's a Midwestern kid who's become this kind of font of the avant theater in New York, I mean, he's almost the kind of guy you think would be somebody like Andre Gregory, in fact, and is not that.
Right, right. Well, yeah, I mean, I think that sort of part of the, was one of the traumas for him in the sort of, in the movie and in the breakup is, you know, we see how he's both, as you were saying, made New York very much his home, but also Nicole's family very much his home. And he's sort of threatened, both of those are threatened in addition to his relationship, his relationship with his son, you know, in terms of, to the degree custody is being debated, you know, that all of these sort of, you know, ways of identifying your selfhood are kind of at risk for him in this movie.
I just was thinking that one of the, I think, one of my favorite scenes you've ever done is the scene, speaking of home, when he goes to visit to California for the first time after the breakup, and he's having a what he thought was a normal conversation with her sister, played by Merritt Weaver. This becomes this kind of traumatic shell game, and to have that happen in a kitchen, in this place that feels like a second home to him.
Right.
And in fact, there's this kind of jealousy that both the daughters have that their mom has still kept the relationship with their all their exes. So for a place that is a home to him, to have his home idea of home stripped away from him, talk about writing this scene, because it's really something. It's really great.
Thank you. Yeah, well, that was, and that, a lot of the sort of blocking of that scene from his point of view was motivated by just what you're saying, which is like he goes immediately to the refrigerator. You see he doesn't ask. He's totally comfortable just seeing what they have to eat, getting it out. He knows where the plates are. He knows where the silverware is. He doesn't think twice at an envelope that's right above the silverware, which of course we know is for us is almost like a bomb that's waiting to go off in this scene. And that casualness and that freedom that he feels, you know, I think makes the scene that much more heartbreaking and tense because you see just what you're highlighting is how much is at risk for him there too. And of course for her too. I mean, she's sort of tasked with having to kind of break this news to him, which is sort of for her a necessary evil, I guess, in a way, in that she, you know, wants to sort of begin the next phase of her life. And this is, you know, the way the lawyer has sort of instructed her to do it. And then he comes in also with this good news that he's just won a MacArthur grant, which also suddenly makes it even harder for her because she is genuinely happy for him too. So it's like, you see this, you know, the scene really did provide a lot of opportunity dramatically in that way because it had all of these things baked into it. And we kind of ran with it in terms of the shooting of it. It was shooting it sort of partly like a screwball comedy, you know, with the sort of entrances and exits and all
those doorways in that kitchen.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a very important location. And something actually we also looked for in all these locations, again, many of them stand-ins for home, was also a theatrical component. Like their home in Brooklyn in the beginning of the movie has a kind of proscenium as they, you know, when they come back to the babysitter you know, that kitchen for sure has all these kind of almost a sense of backstage. And, you know, we sort of stay in the kitchen on stage. So when they leave, we don't see where they go. It does have a kind of backstage quality to it. You know, that his apartment that he sort of his rental apartment, even that sort of spare place has that sort of split kitchen. You know, you can sort of see into the kitchen and to the living room simultaneously, even though they're two separate rooms. It almost has a split screen or like a cross section of a set,
like a scrim. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. All of that was very deliberate because we felt it. You know, again, these were sort of things that were baked into the story and into the movie with these characters going through this situation. Which and another one of it was performance, which of course, you know, that in a sense the lawyers take that role at a certain point in the movie.
We'll take a break. We're talking about the architecture of theater with my guest Noah Baumbach. His newest film is A Marriage Story, Netflix and Theater. So take a break. There's more to come. Stay with us.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. We're still talking about theater. I guess it's Noah Baumbach. His newest film as writer-director is A Marriage Story. It's on Netflix and in theaters. But I just thought in architectural terms, that scene and having it come so early on, puts so much pressure on you as a storyteller, because that's a piece of storytelling in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie, to some extent, feels like it's, and I know this is choreographed, feels like it's finding itself, but that scene suddenly drops an anchor right into the movie. And was it the architecture always such, or did you play around putting that scene other places, or I'm just curious?
I had the idea for that scene, or some version of that scene, I suppose, when I was first sort of started writing. I mean, I knew that I wanted a sequence like that somewhere, but I don't think it ever came earlier in the writing stage. It always sort of fell, you know, where it did. But I was kind of, you know, I think it is, as you say, it was sort of designed to, you know, to sort of shift things, I suppose. I mean, because at that point we're very much with her. We're very much in her kind of perspective of things. You know, as she returns to Los Angeles and she's sort of, you know, both returning to a kind of older life, but trying to start a newer life. And that takes her, you know, through her family, her TV show, her Nora's office, the sort of long monologue she delivers. We're all very much with her there. And so when Charlie even enters at the beginning of that scene, we're still kind of seeing him through her perspective. I mean, it's almost like he's a character in her movie at that point. You know, when he tells her about the MacArthur Grant, it's her experience of hearing that we're sharing. It's not, we don't get to see him find out he won it. And it's not till after that sequence that things start, then we shift a bit over to his perspective for a little bit of stretch of the movie. And so,
well, actually for a pretty long stretch, because it's about a kind of constant dislocation
right.
for him from then on.
Right. And it sort of takes us to when they sort of try to mediate with Bert and Nora in Nora's conference room. But in a sense, that scene was sort of set up to be this sort of, like a little bit of a kind of jolt, because I knew things were going to shift from that point on. It's almost like, yeah, it's like some end of innocence moment.
It's also interesting too, because it feels like, and I mean this in the best possible way, it feels like theater, you know, and it feels like it shifts from being a theatrical farce almost to becoming a John Cassavetes movie.
Right.
Do you
right.
know what I mean? I mean, there's, mm-hmm. because even at some point the lighting gets a little more stark at that point. I mean, there's not as dreamy and sort of soft tone as it was before then.
Yeah, and it's a lot of it's sound too, because it's, you know, you have the sort of clomping around of all the feed and the people going in and out. You have the dialogues constantly overlapping, and you know, there's a kind of song to that in a sense, both with Julie and Merritt and Scarlett first, and then when Adam comes in, it sort of almost becomes cacophonous at times.
We should be talking about Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson and Julie Haggerty and Merritt Weaver.
And Merritt Weaver, yes. And so that when we do have silences, they have, you know, they're sort of maybe more surprising or have different kind of meaning than they would if we hadn't had all the cacophony beforehand. And, you know, and also that sequence, you know, shot mostly in, you know, it's a lot of just moving camera, moving with the characters, medium. There's not any close-ups. When Charlie is served, it's not like we jump in on his face for, you know, a close-up of thing. It's all kept in wide. It's very much Nicole's kind of perspective of what has happened. So again, when we do start to do more close-ups, which comes sort of a little bit later when they're in the mediation office and stuff, it's sort of that sort of feeling of going inside, you know, the sort of inside-outside was another thing we talked about a lot in the movie. I mean, it's the, you know, you feel it in these lawyers' offices where you can see the space of L.A., the landscape of L.A. out the window, but we're very much, as you were saying, kind of like sealed inside in these little capsules in a way. But there was also the sort of, you know, the psychological and emotional interiority of these characters and keeping, you know, some distance at times and then going in close, that we were always very deliberate about that too, because it did sort of, it was a way to emphasize that sort of internal, external.
It's funny, too, because I find myself thinking in the terms of internal, external, that Charlie seems to be lost outside. I think about that scene when he walks outside into Times Square during that phone call when he's in the parking lot with his son in L.A. I mean, he seems to be kind of at a loss when there's not a space that he can sort of inhabit
right.
and control by sheer sort of size of his presence.
Yeah, well, he's a theater director. He's used to controlling the situation. We see that in the beginning of the movie. He's
and controlling interiors as well.
Yes, exactly. And so that was absolutely true. What we were doing in those sequences is by shooting so wide was, you do feel him just at sea in this world. And also, again, you see him in New York City in Times Square, which is his home, which is his place, you know, where he should feel most comfortable. And, you know, once something has changed internally, suddenly that external becomes kind of faceless and no longer feels like home in the same way. We see that, later in a more explicit way when he's sitting in their home and half of the stuff has been moved out. It's like it's no longer the place it was, you know. It's now just a near empty apartment. It's not, you know, but Times Square is the same thing. It's like it doesn't have, you know, suddenly I was thinking about those times in life when something happens that changes, you hear bad news, you hear something, and, you know, suddenly all the places of comfort for you in your life no longer seem quite the same. They seem like something else, or they seem impersonal in a way. They can't comfort you because they, you know, because of what has changed in you.
It's the truth. My guest, who hope didn't damage his beautiful Rolex when he hit it against the desk, is Noah Baumbach, whose new film was writer-director, is a marriage story. But I guess one of the things that I think about, and I guess we've not really talked about this before, is that you tend to write characters who live their lives in theatrical terms, who live their lives to be seen. There's an external component to their lives. And as Charlie's definition is stripped away from him, we get to see how Nicole, he's a director and Nicole's an actress, how as an actress she's really more adept at adapting to the situation than he.
Yeah, although we see how hard it is for her too. I mean, the thing with Nicole's character, she's kind of arrived there at the beginning of the movie. I mean, she's in the most pain at the beginning of the movie. We see it and she's...
But also as an actress, used to sort of like being vulnerable in the way that he's not.
Right, right. Right. He's always kind of catching up. I mean, we thought about it even in his wardrobe that, you know, he's in Los Angeles. He's wearing these sweaters and overcoats. It's like he's still dressing for yesterday. He's like he hasn't caught up to the moment yet. And, you know, that continues throughout the movie. And you know, divorce by design, certainly the legal aspect of it, kind of tries to freeze you because freeze you in place is because you know, because it slows everything down so that the lawyers can try to get as much as they want. They can negotiate. It's all about like forensic breaking down of your life and looking at all these things and saying, well, this happened here, this happened here, and you know. But of course, these are two people who are, you know, for Nicole, she's actively trying to move forward, but this thing is kind of like hanging on, holding on to her and holding her down, whereas he's sort of trying to, I would say, recess backward, and it's holding him in place as well. So you have this sort of, it's like two people caught in quicksand or something, and it's like the more you struggle, the more you're going to sink. You know, and narratively, that was something I felt kind of, I mean, even as when I was working on it, I was kind of excited by, because in the most sort of technical way, a great device to, you know, put people through who are, you know, is to have them sort of trapped in a certain sense in this, you know, within this system.
I guess I should ask you, too, because we talked about this a bit before we got started. I just think A Marriage Story is such a great title for this, because you just use the word forensic, and it is kind of a sort of a forensic disentangling of a marriage. And a really, a title that becomes much more I guess, just and apt as the movie goes on, because I thought when I heard it initially, it sounded almost like an Eric Rohmer movie, mm-hmm. in fact. And in some ways it is, but that title really is there to speak to what the movie's about, isn't it?
Yeah, I sort of was kind of operating on, there's a philosopher, I think it might be Heidegger, but I might be wrong, but who has the sort of notion that when something that you're, that something that you frequent or that you know is ordinary in your life breaks down, like a door that you go through every day doesn't open, you know, your car breaks down, you suddenly look at it in a way that you don't normally look at it. It's clearer to you. It's like more self-evident. And I thought, well, in a sense, that could be true here. If like in telling the story of a divorce, that the marriage in some ways almost becomes, it's like it comes clearer. And you know, the crazy thing is during the divorce, once the lawyers start turning everything into argument, it actually obscures things. It makes it even harder to see. But I felt, though, ultimately, from a dramatic standpoint, I could more clearly tell the story of a marriage this way.
I guess I find myself thinking too that so much happens in your movie, the movies, is about information and people's emotional reactions to it. I mean, there are facts that are kind of the basis of all these films, but everybody has a different point of view about that, those facts. And I guess I'm wondering how conscious a thing that is for you, that people are reacting to this thing that's happened. But if it was just to say, well, these people are getting divorced, that would kind of tell us what's going on. But rather, and especially when your protagonist at the lawyer's office, you get to see that their paranoia, especially Charlie's, is ratcheted up exponentially.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's such, you know, particularly in a situation like this, they're so vulnerable. I mean, Alan Alda's character says at one point, it's, you know, which is something I've heard a few times about divorce, it's like a death without a body. And I think not unlike when someone dies who's close to you, there is this disbelief, you know, you're kind of living the old life emotionally, even though you're intellectually living in the present. So you know someone's gone, but they're still on your phone. You still have some feeling that they're going to call or that you can, you know, or if you go over there, they're still kind of there.
And it also speaks to the fact that everybody surrounding them thinks they're going to get back together.
Right, right. And so I think that divorce does share that in that you're married the whole time you're going through the divorce. So you're still sort of half living in, you know, and emotionally kind of living in the old life, even though you intellectually know this is over. And, you know, we see that both in moments that, you know, that are tender, like her cutting his hair again, you know, or her ordering his lunch for him, you know, this things that where there, this is still residue of what was there. But at the same time, we're still, it's only going in one direction. And so I think the discrepancy of facts and emotional reaction kind of comes in that quite naturally in the movie, because there is this sort of sense of disbelief, and your emotional life is not there yet. It's still like, his clothing. It's still yesterday's.
We're out of time. First of all, I'm so glad you were able to finally come and do this. Thank you so much for doing it, Noah. Thank you.
Me too. This was great.
My guest is Noah Baumbach, whose new film, A Marriage Story, will be playing in New York at the ET at some point. Sorry. Killing myself. A worthwhile double feature, but worth seeing on Netflix with theatrical when you can. Recording engineer here at NPR West is Josh Newell. The show is mixed and edited by Kat Yor. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.